Chapter 29. Years after Dorothy Kilgallen died, an eyewitness account from Johnny Whiteside, Johnny Ray's authorized biographer, provided the following information as to the extent of her probe into JFK's death. He wrote, "Dorothy was in high gear working on the Kennedy assassination, an investigation that demanded more and more of her time. To Johnny, it all seemed quite mysterious." Whiteside added, "She mentioned to Johnny a planned trip to New Orleans for further research into Lee Harvey Oswald's background and connections there, a daunting contradiction of his pro-Cuba street corner politics and incongruous associations with right-wing conservatives and the Carlos Marcello crime family." Since Kilgallen had focused on Ruby since the beginning of her investigation, the comments she made to Ray about researching Oswald's background and his contact with Marcello seem out of sorts. However, author Lee Israel, based on her research, said in a 1995 audio-taped interview, "Kilgallen was tracing Jack Ruby's past, his mob ties." Taking into consideration both Whiteside and Israel's accounts, it appears safe to say Kilgallen had entered the final phase of her investigation with the intent to finally connect Oswald, Ruby, and Marcello to JFK's assassination. This would be the centerpiece of the book she was writing for Random House. Regarding Marcello and Ruby, she must have known that it was nearly impossible to believe Ruby could have operated a strip club in Dallas without Marcello's approval, since his empire stretched, as noted, to that city. Also, Kilgallen had already noted the potential connection of Ruby to Oswald in her DA to link Oswald to Ruby, February 1964 column. Recall she wrote, "The operation of Jack's Carousel Club had its unsavory aspects, but if Oswald checked in there a couple of nights a week, he could have made some extra money." From what Kilgallen learned of the Ruby trial testimony, and from Ruby himself, she knew he had not acted alone when he shot Oswald, just as Oswald had not acted alone when he was, arguably, one of those who assassinated JFK. No wonder she was in high gear in late 1965. The pieces of the puzzle regarding the entire scope of events leading to the president's death were finally coming together. Mark Sinclair's scary details about the New Orleans adventure add to the mystery of that trip and the one she was planning. Though she didn't know it at the time, Kilgallen had an ally in the belief that Ruby was indeed ordered to kill Oswald. In a September 7, 1976 Washington Post column, Jack Anderson wrote of interviewing mobster Johnny Roselli regarding Ruby. Anderson said that Roselli, closely connected to Marcello, told him, "When Oswald was picked up, the underworld conspirators feared he would crack and disclose information that might lead them to them. This almost certainly would have brought a massive U.S. crackdown on the mafia, so Jack Ruby was ordered to eliminate Oswald." Would Kilgallen have pursued interviewing Ruby again if she had lived longer? Marcello must have wondered, after Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade said he was willing to recommend that Ruby's death sentence be reduced to life imprisonment, since there are still a lot of unanswered questions. Wade did not elaborate, and no follow-up article appeared. On October 5, 1966, less than a year after Kilgallen died, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals had ruled, among other matters, that Judge Joe Brown's denial of the change of Ruby's venue motion was a reversible error. Judge W.T. McDonald, after discussing the emotions seething in Dallas after JFK's murder, wrote, "Against such a background of unusual and extraordinary invasions of the expected neutral mental processes of a citizenry from which a jury is to be chosen, the Dallas County climate was one of such strong feeling that it was not humanly possible to give Ruby a fair and impartial trial, which is the hallmark of American due process of law. That climate is what in all likelihood prohibited jurors from carefully scrutinizing Ruby trial testimony, such as his admitting he would be there when Oswald was transferred a denial of justice for certain. A new trial was ordered to be held away from Dallas. Few have known that Wichita, Kansas was selected, but Ruby died before any trial was afforded him. As the days passed, darting toward the fateful November 8, 1965, Kilgallen continued her bulldog state of mind with the second New Orleans trip on the horizon. Jim Kilgallen was right when he said his daughter was courageous. Close friend Maggie McNally also expressed Kilgallen's strong will. Dorothy had a tremendous will to win. As a matter of fact, she'd kill you to win. This strong mindset made her want to win, to solve the case of a lifetime. If Richard Colmar is not the one responsible for Kilgallen's death, and he must remain a strong suspect, then the timing of her demise is important to evaluate. Was the fact that it happened just prior to her second trip to New Orleans a coincidence? Or was the weekend of November targeted for Kilgallen's destruction? Certainly, if there was a mole reporting to his handler Kilgallen's every move, then the trip to New Orleans could not happen, since she had all of the ammunition for a shocking book about the twin assassinations, including secret information from reliable sources, the Ruby interview notes, and knowledge of the Ruby trial transcript testimony conflicting with what Ruby had told her and what was included in the Warren Commission report. She was too close to the truth and had to be stopped. One may imagine a clandestine meeting in the dark corner of an empty tavern, or a hushed voice's phone call, where the decision was made to silence Kilgallen. The famous reporter, like John F. Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald, and Jack Ruby, was doomed. Revisiting the means by which Kilgallen died in a bit more detail foreshadows who may have been the Judas within her camp who betrayed her. The one who, in all likelihood, set Kilgallen up for the kill, or was the killer. Besides James Clement, the most credible witness to what happened the day Kilgallen died is Mark Sinclair. As noted, in the 1990s videotaped interview, he said he entered Kilgallen's home on the morning of November 8th. She had asked him to fix her hair for an appointment she had at Carey's school. Excerpts of the interview are available at the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. Sinclair then detailed his trail to Kilgallen's body, which he was surprised to find in the master bedroom. In a separate audiotaped interview, the hairdresser elaborated on the details. He said Kilgallen was lonely, really lonely, and she proceeded to tell me the situation that occurred in the master bedroom she no longer slept in, which I had often asked why she didn't use that bedroom, since it was so much more convenient. Sinclair, when asked if this was the bedroom where she caught Richard with one of his paramours, apparently a business partner, agreed, stating, "And that was another ironic thing I thought, was that Dorothy would have never slept there, let alone committed suicide there, or even have a fatal overdose there. She hated that bedroom. And we only used it because of the dressing room, or we would have never used it at all." Sinclair then recounted that he found Kilgallen sitting up in bed, and after touching her, knew she was dead. He said the bed was spotless, and was surprised to see that she wasn't wearing her normal bedclothes, pajamas and old socks. And even more surprised, she still had on her makeup, false eyelashes, and hairpiece. Summarizing, Sinclair said Kilgallen was dressed like she was going out, not like she had retired for the night. Continuing, Sinclair mentioned a matching peignoir and robe, a book present on the bed, a drink of some sort on the night table, and a light being on. That the air conditioning was in use confused him, since it was so cold outside, and Kilgallen was always cold. The book, Sinclair mentioned, was The Honey Badger by Robert Ruark, a journalist, author, world traveler, and big game hunter. He was the same Ruark who wrote the column criticizing Frank Sinatra, saying the crooner had frolicked with mobsters during a trip to Havana in 1947. Sinclair, who believed that perhaps someone had turned on the air conditioner to keep the body a certain temperature, said the glass was on the right-hand side, way, way over, and the book was turned upside down. It wasn't in the right position where, if you'd been reading, you'd lay it down, and it was laid down so perfectly. Sinclair continued to describe the scene by mentioning that rigor mortis had set in, and that he noticed a bit of lipstick on the sleeve of the bolero jacket. Note, there is some unexplained confusion as to whether Kilgallen was wearing a matching peignoir and robe, and/or a bolero jacket when her body was discovered by Mark Sinclair. His accounts differ, and unfortunately, those who interviewed him did not ask about the discrepancy. In a 1978 interview, Tudor Ibn Hassan confirmed Sinclair's statement regarding when he found Kilgallen's body. Asked about the accuracy of official reports that the discovery happened at 12:30 p.m., Hassan said, "That is not correct. Her body was found quite early. I would say in the vicinity of 9 o'clock." Continuing on, Sinclair explained, "And I was very upset. So I turned to James, and I said, 'I'm going home. You can reach me there if you want to.' And I left the building." He then added, "When I got downstairs and went out the front door, there was a police car sitting in front of the house. There were two officers in it, sitting right dead in front of the house. They didn't pay any attention to me when I came out. I find it very strange that they were sitting there dead in front of the house, and Dorothy was dead upstairs. Yes, I find it very strange." Regarding being asked to tell his story at the time, Sinclair said, "They called me that night. My then press agent, Jan, I can't remember her last name. Anyway, she called me and asked me to come to Romla Metzler's house, and I did. And the two of them interrogated me, basically trying to find out what I knew about Dorothy's death. And I didn't have very much to tell them," he added. "But why would they call me? Metzler was a Journal American fashion writer." Regarding a newspaper story reporting the maid having discovered the body, Sinclair said, "They mixed that all up, but I don't think I was the first one to find Dorothy. I've never thought that." Ibn Hassan, who described Kilgallen as articulate, very sociable, polite, and elegant in dress and manner, said Sinclair was right. During a November 2015 interview with this author, Dr. Hassan, a distinguished older gentleman with a heavy accent who enjoyed a stellar career in international politics after earning several PhDs, said, "Before I went to class at Columbia around 9 a.m. that Monday, November 8th, I saw all of the servants rushing around the lobby as I was leaving. I asked James what happened. He said, 'Dorothy died. She may have drank too much.' Then I left for class." Hassan also stated he did not recall seeing a police car outside Kilgallen's townhouse, leading credence to his having left for class before Sinclair arrived. Sinclair's actions at the time may be questioned, since he did not stay at the townhouse until police arrived, and then failed to attend Kilgallen's funeral. Regarding the latter, he said, "Her sister Eleanor called me and asked if I would do Dorothy's hair and makeup, because no one knew how to fix her as well as I did. I went to the funeral home, Abbey Funeral Home. I didn't like the funeral director because he was very rude about Dorothy's death." Sinclair added that he did not attend Kilgallen's funeral because, "I did not like the way they were behaving. I didn't like the way the family was behaving. I didn't like the way the press was behaving. I didn't like any of it. I knew more than they did, and I didn't want to be a party to it." Charles Simpson, Kilgallen's alternate hairdresser, adds essential information confirming Sinclair's eyewitness account. He recalled that Sinclair called me on the phone and told me that he had found her dead. And he said, "When I tell you the bed she was found in, and how I found her," he said, "you're going to know she was murdered." And when he told me, I knew. Simpson added, "When Mark told me that day, and then we got back together and he talked to me and told me where he found her, and how it was abnormal. The whole thing was abnormal. It was just abnormal. The woman didn't sleep in that bed, much less the room. And if she still were sharing that room with Richard, that was Richard's bed. That's the one he set fire to. It wasn't her bed." To listen to the original interview, Go to the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. Sinclair was referring to an earlier incident on December 15, 1953. Colmar, apparently in a drunken stupor, had accidentally set his bed on fire with a lighted cigarette after falling asleep. His screams alerted Kilgallen. She rushed to save him. Harold Gold, the fireman who extinguished the fire, appeared on What's My Line on November 14, 1954. Kilgallen did not guess his identity. Fresh evidence garnered by this author in 2017 added to the mystery as to why, how, and by whom Dorothy Kilgallen was murdered. A breakthrough appeared possible when this author was contacted by Caroline Audelette, a friend of Kilgallen's cousin living in Arizona. During a series of phone calls and emails, Audelette provided credible evidence regarding significant facts dealing with Kilgallen's death. "My friend, Dorothy's cousin, looks just like Dorothy. Mannerisms, etc. The way she tilts her head, touches her face. The extended family is monitoring your every move, watching your website, Amazon page, looking for any articles by you, etc. But they still won't speak with you because they want to keep a low profile. They are private, sophisticated people who don't want to lose another family member," emphasis added. The latter statement certainly suggests a strong reference to Dorothy being killed. Audelette would not elaborate when asked to do so, but she added, "Here's a new fact. The family knows that when Dorothy died of drug overdose, her bedclothes would have been soiled due to vomiting, but clothes were never found. They took them, without them saying who they was. The family is frightened. They have led their lives a different way, even on Facebook, but they believe Dorothy was killed and are excited about and supportive of the investigation to the extent that cousin hugged me and we got goosebumps. Finally, justice for Dorothy. Also, they provided facts that the window in the townhouse was open that was never open on the night Dorothy died, and her reading glasses were missing. They said Dorothy would have never committed suicide because she was Catholic. They are still sorting through Eleanor's belongings, and that they knew Carrie was Johnny Ray's son. Just look at a picture of Carrie and Johnny Ray. That's his son." Jim Kilgallen was interviewed in 1980, but he didn't want to speak about Dorothy's death, fearing it would cause a commercial use of her life. The cousins are sophisticated, soft, private people. Sad but true was the relatives revealing that, while they believed Kilgallen was killed and were excited about any investigation that would result in justice for Dorothy, they were frightened because they don't want to lose another family member. Despite several attempts to do so, this author was unable to speak directly with Kilgallen's cousins. The disappointment continued when Kilgallen's niece, Catherine Shusha, who at times used Kilgallen's last name on her Facebook page, along with posting photos of her, failed to respond to telephone messages this author left for her in Los Angeles. This refusal to cooperate even extended after Audelette met Catherine in California. Audelette described her as being very petite. "She has Eleanor's," Kilgallen's sister's, "smile, the Kilgallen confidence, and is a lot of fun. She does not resemble Eleanor, only a few features. However, her grandmother told her she reminded her of Dorothy." On the same Facebook page, Shusha posted a Kilgallen quote, "The world is grand, awfully big and astonishingly beautiful, frequently thrilling." Also failing to cooperate was Eleanor's daughter, Susan Snaper Shusha. In mid-February 2018, this author left a telephone message for her, but there was no return call. The comment by her cousin's go-between that the relatives are still sorting through Eleanor's belongings meant Kilgallen's JFK assassination investigation file could have been among them. Certainly Kilgallen trusted her sister, and if she did in fact have a copy of the file, Eleanor would have been the logical one to receive it. By not cooperating, Susan Shaper-Shusha prevented any potential to search Eleanor's belongings. The non-cooperation by Eleanor's daughter was especially disappointing, since Kilgallen had apparently come to her rescue when Jim and May Kilgallen disapproved of Eleanor marrying a Jewish man. Recall May had shown her colors when she refused to take young Dickie Kolmar to the Bronx Zoo because she was uncomfortable around Jewish people. When no one in the family would permit the wedding to be held at another family member's home, Kilgallen offered the townhouse. A gala affair was the result, thanks to Dorothy. One family member who finally agreed to speak to this author about Kilgallen was J. Christopher Pryor, an attorney and former assistant district attorney and assistant attorney general in Topeka, Kansas, a second cousin who had researched his connection through DNA results. Pryor, while he did not have first-hand information about her death, but provided photos of her great-grandparents and the original Kilgallen home in Ireland, said, "Dorothy is a real inspiration." He added, "Relying only on her ability and hard work, she rose to the top of her field without the aid of the women's rights movement. Her tenacity was only matched by her character, as evidenced by her refusal to reveal her source to the FBI when they demanded to know where she obtained the Warren Commission's interview of Jack Ruby." Mark Sinclair's recollections of what transpired on the day Kilgallen died must be given serious consideration, but the recollections of Brenda DeJordan add a credible account as well. Concerning the relationship between her father and Kilgallen, DeJordan said, "My father was very protective of Dorothy. When the FBI came to the house before Dorothy's death to question her about the Ruby Warren Commission exposure, Dad said to Dorothy, 'You are going to get yourself in trouble.'" Regarding what happened prior to Kilgallen leaving for her final What's My Line appearance, DeJordan said, "My father told my mother that something had happened earlier that night prior to her getting home, that Dorothy was upset about something." This coincides with Sinclair's recollection that he believed Kilgallen had received a phone call causing her to change the dress from a flashy one to a date-date dress. Recreating what she recalled occurring in the townhouse after Kilgallen arrived home, DeJordan said her father told her, "A gentleman was with Dorothy when she came into the townhouse. Somehow my father saw him. There was evidence of his being there. He said he didn't know the gentleman, but when my father went to bed, he was still there." Continuing, DeJordan said, "My father said he heard a noise, and it could have been the man leaving." Explaining, she said, "On the first floor, there was a door to the backyard, a screen door, and that night it was unlocked. My mother said, 'Maybe that is what you heard, the screen door closing.'" Asked when her father first discovered Kilgallen's body the next morning, DeJordan replied, "My father went to look for Dorothy in the townhouse. When he went into the spare bedroom, she wasn't there. My dad found the body. She was in a very different place, in the bathroom, my father said, different from where the authorities found her." Apparently, James Clement first told his wife Kilgallen was dead before informing Richard, who in all likelihood was still asleep in his fourth-floor bedroom. What Richard did with regard to his wife's body could not be confirmed by DeJordan. Told Mark Sinclair said he came to the townhouse and found Kilgallen's body, and then called James on the intercom and he came running up the stairs, DeJordan said, "Sounds about right." Regarding the physical appearance of Kilgallen's body, DeJordan said, "My father told my mother that Dorothy had something different on, clothes, from when he first saw her body, and then later on. My father said that when he saw her body in the bedroom, there were no pills on the night table, but later there were pills on the night table." She added, "Dad said that the way Dorothy's body was found later was not the way he found her before. Told Mom, 'I didn't find her like that. Body moved. Position wrong. Clothes she wore. The glass wasn't there. On the nightstand. Didn't understand how she took pills with alcohol.'" Commenting further, DeJordan told this author, "When my father saw Dorothy's body in the bedroom, he said, 'She doesn't go to bed like this. Hairpiece, eyelashes, etc. Not in these bedclothes.' He also wanted to know why would the air conditioner be on. He knew something was wrong, and he wondered why the dressing room closet was a mess, in disarray. 'Not like Dorothy,' he said. 'It's not real. She didn't overdose.'" Concerning Mark Sinclair's demeanor, DeJordan told this author, "My father said Mark was a basket case, and crying after he found her body. He said they killed her. They finally killed her." Solidifying the fact that Clement and Sinclair were close friends, ones who both cherished their relationships with Kilgallen, DeJordan stated, "Mark was a homosexual, and he talked to my father about it. Dad told him it's who you are, and then teased him about it to make Mark feel more comfortable. Sharing thoughts about his sexual orientation with Clement meant Sinclair trusted him, as Kilgallen trusted both men." DeJordan said there would have been a problem with anyone in the townhouse knowing what might have happened on the third floor. "It was very tough to hear from the third floor to the fourth floor," she told this author. "A person would have to really be loud. Even when there were big parties, it was hard to hear from floor to floor."